This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
ACR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers, and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast. Oh, yeah. Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. until 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Grab your pants.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to 3CR Breakfast. Today is Tuesday, the 14th of October, 2025. And firstly, we'd like to thank the Radioactive Show, 3CR's national program on nuclear peace and energy issues. My name is Fung, and in the studio with me today is Elena.
Hello.
Hello. How are you going, Elena?
I'm good. Busy morning, but I made it successfully.
Oh my gosh, busy morning. It's only 7 a.m. Does that mean you've been doing... You've already been doing things this morning.
Yes.
Oh my gosh.
Been out and about, up and at 'em.
Wow.
But
is this like a new like springtime attitude?
I think it's everything is happening all at once.
Yes.
And there are only so many hours in the day. So yeah. I gotta use as many as I can.
Yeah. Okay, wow, that's such a like go getting attitude. For anyone listening at home who feels like maybe they needed a bit of a pep talk, that was your pep talk for this morning.
You're welcome.
Yeah. Okay, we've got such a big show today. So perhaps we'll start by giving everyone a rundown on what's coming up. So at 7:15, we will be joined in the studio by Lisa Brand, who is a founding member of the Gippsland Forest Guardians. Lisa's been on the show before talking about the Strzelecki Forest and Fellers Coupe. So she'll be on the show this morning with some exciting updates regarding this area. Then at 7:30, we'll be joined again by Lucinda Thorpe, who is the privacy campaigner at Digital Rights Watch. And this time, Lucinda will be chatting to us about the City of Melbourne Council's proposal to expand the CCTV network and what that means for our privacy and our safety. At 7:45, we will share an interview that Julia had with writer and teacher Soren Tay Smith about her recently released memoir called Honey from the Ground, which is an exploration of her personal experience of loss after the death of her son. So that will be coming up at 7:45.
At 8 a.m., we'll be joined by Orly and Alex from Demilitarize RMIT, who will speak about the militarization of universities as well as their upcoming event, Military Industrial Academic Complex. And at 8:15, we'll be speaking to Georgie Stone, who is the producer of Ascension, a play coming up at Fringe Festival from October 16th to 19th.
So, like I said before, a massive show, so make sure you stick around, stay tuned to 3CR on 8:55 a.m. We'll be back with the news headlines in just a moment.
Some folks know about it, some don't. Some will learn to shout it, some won't. But sooner or later, baby, here's a ditty, say you're gonna have to get right down to the real nitty gritty. Let's get right down to the real nitty gritty now.
You're listening to Tuesday Breakfast on 8:55 a.m, 3CR Digital and 3cr.org.au. And these are the news headlines for Tuesday, the 14th of October, 2025. Dr. Bianca Webb-Pullman was one of seven Australian activists who had been detained in Israel's Ketziyot prison and was part of the global Smud flotilla attempting to deliver aid to Gaza through Israel's naval blockade of the city. Israel intercepted hundreds of members of the flotilla last week, abducting and detaining them in the Israeli prison. Last Sunday, Dr. Bianca Webb-Pullman spoke at the rally for Palestine, which ended outside the US consulate. She detailed the abuse the activists endured and witnessed, as well as the failings of the Australian government, which provided minimal support to the seven activists. Since their release, Dr. Bianca's mother, Julie Webb-Pullman, along with other activists and their families, have been critical of the Australian government's response in the days after their detention, calling it slow and uncommunicative. The comments have followed a call from a New South Wales Greens MP to investigate claims of torture and mistreatment of the Australians after detained activist Surya McEwen claimed his arm had been dislocated after rough treatment by Israeli authorities.
Also in the news, Oxfam Australia has released a new report, The Elephant in the Room, Australia's Failure to Tax Wealth. The report outlined how the tax system is deepening inequality in Australia by failing to adequately tax wealth. It shows how Australia has become a nation for the wealthy, not workers, by providing tax discounts that predominantly benefit the wealthy and failing to tax the growth in extreme wealth. The report focused on one tax discount in particular, the 50% capital gains discount, which allows people to sell an investment to only pay income tax on half the profits from the sale. The report found the capital gains tax discount disproportionately benefited people on high incomes, deepening the inequality and failing to provide a fair go for workers who pay tax on their full income. The report also found addressing growing inequality and better taxing wealth has popular support in Australia. 72% of Australian voters would support the introduction of a wealth tax on billionaires and the super rich, while 68% of Australians support the additional revenue raised by a wealth tax being invested in property-reducing measures, such as public and affordable housing and increasing income support. The funds raised from a wealth tax could help end poverty in Australia. $33.5 billion per year is enough to raise income support payments above the poverty line, build 50,000 new social housing properties a year, and invest in better health and social services. It is also enough to scale up international aid to build a stable and prosperous region. In other news, the World Heritage Outlook report published by the IUCN over the weekend has revealed that invasive species remain one of the most destructive and widespread threats to Australia. The report analyzed World Heritage sites across the globe, assessing their protection and management needs. The report found that invasive species present a high or very high threat to 9 of the country's 12 World Heritage sites. The Invasive Species Council is calling for stronger environmental laws to addressed the threat of invasive species to nature. Carol Booth, policy director of the council, expressed that the report is a wake-up call. Invasive species are tearing through places that define Australia's global reputation for natural beauty and outstanding biodiversity values. She continued, from feral cats hunting mammals in Kakadu to fire-fueling buffalo grass taking over the Uluru and myrtle rust killing ancient trees in Gondwana rainforests, the damage is relentless and accelerating.
Finally, in the headlines, new research has found that 1 in 7 people in Australia are living in poverty. The report conducted by the Australian Council of Social Services and the University of New South Wales showed that 3.7 million people were living in poverty in the years 2022 to 2023. Compared to 2020 to 2021, 1 in 8 people were living in poverty. The latest research uncovered that 1 in 6, or 757,000 children, are living in poverty. The report also analysed rental increases, revealing that median rents had increased in the period June 2021 to June 2023 by 34% in Melbourne, 40% in Sydney, and 41% in Brisbane. Dr. Yuvisthi Naidu, Senior Research Fellow at the UNSW Social Policy Research Centre, commented in response to the findings, "This is unacceptable in one of the wealthiest countries in the world." Naidu pointed out that the number of people living in poverty decreased in 2020 due to the temporary effective doubling of JobSeeker through the COVID supplement, but has since sharply risen to be now above pre-pandemic levels with the removal of the COVID payments and dramatic rising housing costs. These have been the news headlines for Tuesday, the 14th of October, 2025, and you're listening to 3CR Breakfast on 855 AM.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings, cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
Women on the Line, a radical intersectional current affairs program.
Making space for the voices of women and gender diverse people.
Featuring in-depth conversations with guests from SoCalled Australia and beyond.
Ultimately, we're looking to care for country, to continue our culture, to continue our ceremonies, so that our children have a strong sense of self and belonging.
Just because our marginalisation intersect where we're both disabled, it doesn't change your white privilege. It doesn't change your straight privilege. It doesn't change your able-bodied privilege.
Sex work, the word itself, has been such a word with a lot of stigma. However, we cannot ignore that there are women out there who are making their livelihood out of this job.
Listen every Monday morning at 8:30 on 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM, or stream live on 3cr.org.au.
Love podcasts? We've got you. Find Women on the Line via the Community Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Women on the Line, where about?
Feminisms in their multitudes.
First Nations sovereignty.
Land back.
Trans liberation. Poo-poo on the turfs.
Abolition.
Anti-racism.
Sex worker rights.
Staff liberation.
Disability justice.
Anti-imperialism.
Decolonisation.
An end to borders.
Workers' justice.
And so much more.
Women on the Line, broadcasting on the 3CR airwaves since 1986.
Woo! Woo!
I just think that it's ironic that the state of Victoria want to treaty with Aboriginal people but have no issue in destroying our sacred sites.
War is devastating on the environment. In peacetime, the military is a huge user of fossil fuels, a huge driver of nuclear energy, and ultimately the architect of nuclear weapons.
Subscribe to 3CR, fighting for social justice and environmental change.
And to all the people that are so afraid of the solutions to climate change that they choose to live in denial instead, the current solutions to the climate emergency are much easier to cope with than the outcomes that will come if we don't.
Feed Radical Radio, go to 3cr.org.au/subscribe or call the station on 9419 8377.
Follow the sun, which way the wind blows.
Public transport's great.
What's not great is that unless you've got a radio with you, you can't listen to 3CR when you're on it.
Until now. The Community Radio Plus app lets you listen to us wherever you are.
Get on board and search Community Radio Plus wherever you get your apps.
Times on my mind when I had to find my side. Am I thinking loud? Do I want you around?
You're listening to 3CR Tuesday Breakfast on 855 AM, 3CR Digital and 3cr.org.au. And we are now joined in the studio by Lisa Barand, who is a founding member of the Gippsland Forest Guardians, a small team working with community to protect Gippsland's forests for future generations of animals, plants and people. And regular listeners of 3CR will know that Lisa has joined us on the show a couple of times before. But this time we're excited to have her back because there are some positive developments regarding Fellers Coop and the future of the Strzelecki forests. So welcome back to 3CR, Lisa.
Thanks so much, Fong. It's amazing to be here today.
So won't drag it out for too long, so we'll just get straight to it. What can you tell us about Fellers Coop and the recent news regarding this area?
Sure. So as you know, we've been working for almost 2 years now to protect the rare and threatened species on this particular logging coop. And a couple of weeks ago, HVP, the logging company, has made an announcement in writing that instead of managing that site for plantation, they are instead going to regenerate the site to native forest for the long term. And this is just such an amazing outcome. We're just pinching ourselves every day that it's happened, and we're so delighted.
Yeah, that's incredible news. And I think when we're living at a time when good news seems quite rare, it really is such an incredible decision and a testament to your hard work at GFG, but also the wider community and other groups that are advocating for native forests. So can you tell us more about this decision? Did it come out of nowhere? Were you expecting HVP to make a statement? Just tell us more about it.
Sure. So no, they let us know before they made that statement, which is very good of them. Did we expect it? I feel like the pressure from the campaign had put some pretty uncomfortable scrutiny on HVP from multiple directions. So obviously this was our hope, that the sustainability of that site would be seen by everyone as the right way forward. But when it actually came, it was a surprise. So an amazing outcome. So much community contribution to that, you know, what we've actually been able to achieve. It's funny you say, like, the work of GFG, that there's really only three or four or five of us, you know, so it's not us, it's actually the community. Can I tell you a quick story?
Yeah, please.
Yeah. So the other day I ran into a young person. When you say about sharing young, you know, really good news, to me, more than ever, it's just in my heart that young people need to hear these stories. So I ran into this student that I know from a school, Woodley School. They're actually really interested in what we do, and they've had groups down there. So this student was aware of what was going on, and he knew about the outcome, but I just bumped into him in the shops down the street. And when he saw me, he was so stoked. I just can't tell you how happy he was. And he said something to me like, you know, oh, all the great work that you've done at GFG. And I looked at him and I thought, no, this is actually your work, because it's him and his, fellow students who have been writing to the minister about the lack of GFG protections. I've read their submissions. You know, I know they've done it. They wrote submissions to the FSC. That was not an easy process. And thank you to all your listeners, by the way, who were part of that. So actually it's their win, and what a thing for them to be able to see that it's actually worth fighting and advocating for the important things. Mm. Yeah, It's that's really where I'm at personally with it.
Yeah, that's such a beautiful story. And it just goes to show that I think, you know, young people are really passionate. I think there's often these narratives of young people being apathetic or but they're not. They do really care, and sometimes, you know, they just need a bit of guidance on what to do or how to go about it, which is why I guess groups like Gippsland Forest Guardians but other collectives can help guide community members to show them how to go about things. And of course there's strength in numbers, so that's incredible news. Is there a timeline for this? Is it an immediate halting of operations? Do you know much about the logistics regarding the withdrawal?
So it's early days, and we've got some meetings lined up with HVP and also with the council to talk about what the what you call regeneration is going to look like. So there's about 50 hectares, which is, you know, let's say 50 MCGs that was logged last year. And our understanding is that those areas are going to be regenerated. So that means, you know, replanted with the right species that are ecologically appropriate, which is basically tall, wet eucalypt forest, mountain ash, beautiful. I will say, I don't know if your listeners saw a little post we did on Instagram a couple of weeks ago, but nature is doing an amazing job already. We've been looking, and, you know, the seed bank is already popping up all the species you would expect to see there. So that's great, but it's still going to need some care. So that needs to be regenerated. The other area is about 19 hectares, which we had been claiming is native forest. It hadn't been logged, but on HVP's maps, it's shown as plantation. That now will not be logged either. So that's what we know. And I guess from our supporters' perspective, I would think that they're looking to us to make sure that those things happen in the right way and are locked in for the long term. You know, we have a good sense that HVP is absolutely committed to this and for the right reasons, no problem. But things change in the future, so we really want to make sure that it's done properly and that the land is protected in perpetuity.
Yeah, definitely. And will there be any groups that get to oversee the regeneration to ensure that this is being done the right way?
Yeah, so that's a really good question, and that they're the things that we'll definitely be talking to HVP and also the council about. It's not our job to be a regulator. You know, we don't want to be doing that, but it's important that it's done right. And so, you know, to the extent that we see that in the past things haven't been done right and the oversight from, you know, regulators and others hasn't been great, we really want to make sure that it is good from now on. So we'll be involved in that to the extent that people want us to be involved and try and make sure that it's done in a really sustainable way.
Yeah. And then in terms of the future for the Strzelecki Forest, for the Slender Tree Ferns, but also for yourself as a collective, is there anything that you are currently working on or that you're keeping your eye out on for the future?
So this decision that's been made is a good decision. You know, it's a good decision for nature. It's a good decision for the community. It's also a good decision in terms of building HVP's reputation as a sustainable organisation. So we haven't spoken to them, as I said. We're going to have a sit down in a couple of weeks. But I would hope personally that having made this decision on this kind of piece of land with these ecological contexts around it, that it would be a template for other sites, really. And that's consistent with the FSC. And we know there are a lot of similar sites. It's not our favourite day when we make complaints, but we're already talking to all the right stakeholders about other sites that are exactly the same in their ecological context. So, you know, it's a good approach, and I would really hope that that's what's taken forward. So that will be a big priority for us, absolutely. The other is sharing some knowledge, really, like you said, you know, how the you know, helping the community understand how to kind of take the approach that we've taken, perhaps. Since all this has happened, we get calls every week from people who are very distressed by what's happening in their own area and asking for advice. Like, we're not experts, but we have one story to tell about the, you know, our learnings, and we're going to be finding ways to share those learnings. So that's another focus.
Amazing. And I feel like this is a story that's just continuing to evolve with new updates. And like you said, hopefully we can see similar outcomes for other sites across Victoria, where there are so many local community groups who are trying to save their patch of native forest. Unfortunately, that's all we have time for this morning, Lisa. So thank you so much again for coming in. But before we leave today, I know you have shared some audio with me that I'm going to play for our listeners. So I was wondering if you could give a short introduction to what I'm about to play.
Absolutely. Before I do, thank you, Fong. Thanks for giving us a voice, and thank you to all your listeners for all their ongoing support. So, yeah, people enjoyed, I think, the lyrebirds last time. So this is a dawn recording, over 8 or 9 species, not 8 or 9 birds, but different species on this recording, including gangangs, which are EPBC listed. And so enjoy.
So we've been speaking to Lisa Barand, a founding member of the Gippsland Forest Guardians. To keep up to date with campaigns, head to gippslandforestguardians.org.au. The collective also recently ran a webinar with Victorian Forest Alliance. So if you'd like to learn more about their efforts to protect Fellers Coop, you can also find that on their website. We are going to play a song now, and I feel like it's just fitting for the discussion that Lisa and I just had. This is by Goanna. This is from their 1982 album Spirit of Place, and the song is called Stand Your Ground.
When you wake up one morning and they're pounding at your door, telling you your business and what you're doing it for. They might have a warrant, might have a law on their side, but when they come with daggers in their eyes, don't take them. Stand your ground, we're all on the one way from
Hi, my name is Miss Kinnan. I'm a proud Yorta, Jajarong, Kalkadoon and Yirrindali Aboriginal Sovereign Woman. And you're listening to 3CR, guys. Check in with your friends. Make sure you guys are going good. And also stick up for what's right, yeah? Free Palestine.
We were listening to the song Stand Your Ground by Gowanna, and you're listening to 3CR Tuesday Breakfast on 855 AM. And we are now joined by Lucinda Thorpe, who is a privacy campaigner at Digital Rights Watch, and she joins us on the program again today to discuss the City of Melbourne Council's proposal to expand the CCTV network, as well as give greater powers for staff using the footage. Welcome back to the show, Lucinda.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you so much for joining us again. I feel like we're speaking to you a lot lately. There just seems to be so much news out there regarding technology and use of surveillance technology, AI and things like that. And I guess, all of this technology is evolving rapidly and we're seeing so many institutions and corporations use it. So I guess it's really important to have you back on the show to talk to us about our rights. But before we go into it, what can you tell us about the City of Melbourne Council's plan to add 100 cameras, including 60 privately owned cameras, to the city's CCTV network?
Yeah, absolutely. So this plan came to light in a Melbourne Council meeting last Tuesday. There had been talk kind of earlier throughout the year about implementing AI, like facial recognition systems to help prevent crime, but this is the first we're hearing of this plan to expand the network. So the plan, as you said, is to add 100 additional CCTV cameras into the Melbourne Council area, 40 of which would be owned by the council and then 60 are privately owned. Now, we don't know yet what is quite meant by privately owned, if they would be administered by a security company or if it's being owned by 60 private entities. We are not yet sure. So currently the council already has a 300 camera strong system, of which only about 18 are privately owned. So this would represent a massive jump in the number of privately owned cameras feeding into the council's monitoring operations. Mm. The impact assessment of the proposed expanded powers by the law firm Maddox found the cameras would likely capture personal and potentially sensitive information. And as for budget, this plan will cost $3.6 million for the Victorian government and $2.1 million from Melbourne Council.
Wow, that's a lot of money there. And so when you're talking about personal data, sensitive data, can you tell us a bit more about what that would mean?
Yeah, absolutely. So personal data refers, or personal information refers to anything essentially that would be able to identify you. So if you're walking around and your face is captured on there, that would be able to identify you. So we can call it personal information. Now, sensitive information is things like your political leanings, your religious affiliations, things that are a little more likely to be able to be used against you, such as your sexual orientation. So if you were walking past one of these security cameras with a same-sex partner and you have some PDA, then that camera would have captured sensitive information about you.
Mm. And we'll get into the impacts of surveillance technology in just a moment, but are there currently any regulations in place concerning the use and control of CCTV footage, as well as ownership of the data or the footage and where it's stored?
Yep. So as to who owns the data and how long it's kept for, this is something that Councillor Olivia Ball questioned in the council meeting last Tuesday. Specifically, she questioned data ownership and accountability and asked whether private operators could retain copies of the footage and how long recordings were kept and whether the council's privacy policies would be applied to the private firms. We're disappointed, but not surprised by the answers that she received. So she was told that the council's policy of deleting the footage after 28 days would not apply to the private companies who own the cameras, and that private companies would essentially own the footage and have the ability to make a copy of it. And as I said before, we don't know anything about these private companies. We don't know how many they are. We don't even know if they fall under the Privacy Act. This case really highlights the importance of strong privacy laws, because the regulations of the private camera holders, it depends so much on information that we just don't have available to us yet. So I said before, if they're a small business making under $3 million or if the company has a contract regarding the CCTV sharing with the Victorian government, then they're exempt from the Privacy Act. Local councils such as Melbourne Council are subject to the information privacy principles under the Privacy and Data Protection Act. However, there are very broad exceptions in there for law enforcement purposes, meaning that the whole CCTV operation likely would fall out of scope. It'd only be subject to very few information privacy principles. And without knowing more details, I can't say to the extent that the storage, collection, use and transfer of this security footage will actually be regulated. And that is ridiculous. If our council is going to systemically record us and surveil us, we should be able to say with confidence that we trust our privacy laws to protect us, regardless of whether or not it's a small company or they have a contract or they don't have a contract. We need to be confident in our privacy laws to protect us.
Yeah, that is truly terrifying. And I think, you know, for you, Lucinda, who, you know, you work in this area, and I imagine at DRW you'd have so many resources to look into this if you are unable to find more information about, you know, what this means for the private companies who use this data or all this footage. I just think about, you know, everyday people who want to know more about their rights or where footage of them is going, it just feels like it would be impossible to find out. So hopefully, yeah, there's some clarity that comes from this draft plan soon. There are also discussions on the potential use of AI video analysis. What does this mean?
AI video analysis means trouble in this context. I said last time I was on here about the impacts of AI on using AI in law enforcement context and how that can really compound bias against people of colour. And this is just another example of that. So Lord Mayor Nicholas Rees has already floated using AI to analyse the CCTV for facial identification. He mentioned tracking offenders' gait or distinctive clothing items like a backpack. And it's unclear whether this technology would be applied to all security camera footage, including the private camera footage under the current proposed policy. And frankly, the mayor is not reading the room at all. So he's talking about how exciting this technology is and all of the brilliant ways that AI surveillance is being used around the world to keep people safe. And while he's right that it's being used around the world, it's not going swimmingly and it's not always keeping people safe. So the facial identification tech out there is faulty and it's biased. So using it in a law enforcement context is incredibly ill-advised. For example, people from West Africa are 7 times more likely to be misidentified as a match in facial surveillance systems, making them more likely to be targeted by police. In the context of local crime like vandalism and public nuisance, which is what this new CCTV program aims to target, people of colour are more likely to be incorrectly identified as being in the footage, placing them in contact with the police and potentially even with the legal system. So this surveillance will directly contribute to the over-policing of people of colour. So my question is, how can a technology that actively disadvantages people of colour be keeping the community safer? Because people of colour are the community. So if it's not keeping them safer, who is it keeping safer?
Yeah, that's such an interesting point that you make there. It's like it really just goes to show that you know, reading between the lines, you can come to understand what certain people mean about who is part of the community, what it means to be safe. Safety and what is required for that quote-unquote safety, which is, all quite dark. Unfortunately, we only have time for one more question, Lucinda. So last time, you know, like you just said, we discussed the impacts of facial surveillance tech in stores, and now we're discussing the expanded CCTV network in the city. Does Digital Rights Watch have any concerns regarding what seems to be, you know, the pervasive use of surveillance technology in our cities?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So what we're seeing is that there's insufficient scrutiny on the ways in which personal info is shared between public and private entities. So there's very few limitations in the law that kind of regulate that interaction. So in Melbourne and likely Sydney, there's already a rollout of infrastructure of technological surveillance, and it's got very little transparency. There are lots of cameras designed to monitor pedestrian and vehicle traffic, and we have such little information regarding how long this information is kept and used. And we think it warrants greater accountability and transparency. And beyond that, you have surveillance technology everywhere. If you're listening to this in your smart car, it can record where you go, what you say, how long you stop for, your driving habits. If you're on your phone, it can sell cookies, and it can track your use of the phone and websites and social media, so you can be micro-targeted with ads and influence. Surveillance is a massive problem in today's society. And when people are being watched, they're more obedient. They're less likely to take risks and express themselves freely. Mm. So it's easy to fantasize about a Melbourne free from crime, but a free and flourishing society is not one being watched.
Mm. Yeah, and especially when we have people who are who perhaps do not have, you know, the luxury of expressing themselves freely due to, you know, like discrimination or something like that, for there to be this aspect now of like constant surveillance and a potential threat of like sharing that footage or using it against these people is truly terrifying. Thank you so much, Lucinda, for joining us on the show this morning to talk about the CCTV plan for the City of Melbourne Council. We'll be watching that very closely and may speak to you again about any updates.
No worries. Thank you so much for having me on.
We've been speaking to Lucinda Thorpe, privacy campaigner at Digital Rights Watch. Head to www.drw.org.au for more information about the organisation, as well as information on your rights. We'll be back with the next segment after these announcements.
Hello there. I'm Virginia from The Gardening Show. What if there was a viable solution to climate change? Treasured Perennials Nursery are sponsoring a screening of Kiss the Ground documentary, exploring how, through our soils, we can stabilise the Earth's climate, restore lost ecosystems, and provide future food security. A mini event with stalls, demonstrations, and a Q&A session. It's going to be at Fernie Creek Horticultural Society, which is in Hilton Road in Sassafras, on November the 15th, 11:30 to 4 p.m. Tickets will be $15.50 through TryBooking. Head to trybooking.com and search for Kiss the Ground. All proceeds, of course, are donated to 3CR. Treasured Perennials Nursery is a 3CR supporter and regularly appear on The Gardening Show.
You're listening to 3CR Tuesday Breakfast, and I'll hand over to Julia now for the next segment.
A few weeks ago, I spoke to writer and teacher Soren Tay Smith about her recently released memoir called Honey from the Ground. The book is an exploration of her personal experience of loss after the death of her son. Here, Soren discusses the passing of time, her memories and thoughts of single motherhood in the eyes of society, and begins with an anecdote of people's reactions to discussing grief. Take a listen.
I actually just came from an appointment, and when I was there, the entire electrics behind the desk of the people that were at the appointment, the electrics went down, so their computer, their FPOS, everything went down. So I was there waiting for a while, and while I was there, I said, look, I might have to actually come back because I'm going to go and talk to Julia at 3CR. And they said, oh, why? And I said, oh, it's... you know, it's an interview about a book, and she gets out her pen, she wants to write down the name of the book. And I said, well, it's called Honey from the Ground. She said, oh, I love that title. What's it about? And I said, it's about bereavement, actually. It's about grief and child bereavement. And she's like, oh, I'm so sorry. Almost as if to say, I wish I hadn't asked. So I never want anyone to feel that way about the book. It's a beautiful book. I'm really proud of it. And I, you know, of all the things that I've ever written in my life, it's the thing I most wanted to share. Definitely wanted to share it. So ask me anything you want to know.
Yeah, I guess the book definitely discusses grief, which is, yeah, sometimes like an uncomfortable topic. So I feel like I really appreciate the way that you explore it in this very poetic but also real way. What was your experience with unpacking it and understanding it?
Yeah, I feel like there are some strange misconceptions about parental grief and sibling grief too, although I can't speak to that. But my other kids, of course, they experience sibling grief. I experienced, you know, child loss. My son was 19 when he passed away. And for me, it was a process of coming to terms with the passage of time. And a lot of bereaved parents do say that, that it's like time no longer makes any sense. You know, in the start of the book, it's like, you know, his 20th birthday will soon not occur. And it's just unfathomable to me that time would continue. And a lot of people in bereavement, they say that, like, how can time just pass in this way? And for me, the writing process was actually like a way of learning to harness time and make sense of time, because I sort of wrote a path for myself and then walked on it, if that makes any sense. I don't know. I just sort of wrote and then walked. And I didn't actually walk. I literally stayed in bed for 4 months, apart from online teaching. But, you know, it was like the process of bereavement was kind of like reorienting myself in time without leaving behind my three kids, keeping them all with me, not just two of them, but keeping them all with me and being able to live in the present while still weaving the past into the present. Yeah, you can't rush into the future after you've had a huge shock and bereavement. You have to have a very gentle time of sitting with the grief, I think.
I think so too. Mm. Yeah, and I think this kind of like links, I suppose, to one of the things in the description was that the dead can be our best mentors, which I thought was really interesting.
Yeah.
And yeah, how do you find that exists within life?
That's a great question, because it's so wild, really. I think a lot of parents would say they learn a lot from their kids, but I definitely don't think that's what our kids are for, is like to teach us. It's like, oh, how convenient, our kids are teaching us stuff. It's like we really do need to be there for them and teach them. But it is a bit of a two-way street, isn't it? And when you feel that you, like, to respect the dead, like I feel like the world is kind of made of the deeds, the words and the presence of the dead amongst us. Like I really believe that, and I've always believed, I've always felt that. Not even a belief, really, just like my feeling is like what we're living and walking around in is like the world of the dead. And here we are. What are we going to do with it? What are we going to make of that? And how are we going to respect that? So when your child goes ahead of you and is then part of that mentorship, and you realize that your life is not leaving the past behind, but you're actually moving forward towards meeting the people who've gone ahead before you and passed away before you. You're going towards them to meet them again. The mentorship in that is very profound to me. And when somebody meets the end of their life at a young age, especially, it really makes you renegotiate everything that you believe about what is important in this world. Yeah. And one of the things that made me renegotiate is the importance of the living compared to the importance of the dead. And, I hope that makes some kind of sense.
It's interesting, yeah, because I think even when someone does pass away, they pass away, but their spirit still lingers almost. I think even through the mundane, even through, like, the simple things is how we often, like, remember people.
Yeah.
And I noticed one theme that I really appreciated. You also touch on the beauty of the everyday and the mundane, almost the importance in that, especially after you've lost someone, because that's what kind of becomes almost sacred.
Yeah. I think for me previously, I got a lot of my, like for my whole life, I had a lot more to do with books and the world of writing and the world of reading since I was little. Mm-hmm. And it's really one of the first things that I clung onto as a human after I was born was like the alphabet, you know. Mm-hmm. A lot of children are big fans of the alphabet and also the numbers up to 10. And to me, they were my friends and they were like the thing that made sense of the world for me. So I just went pretty hardcore into the world of writing and reading. And that's where I kept my connection to what was sacred and what was profound and important, and what was also fun and enjoyable and, you know, flow states and things like that was always for me through reading and writing. And mostly that is to do with, even though some things are contemporary, a lot of it is to do with the literature of the past as well.
Yeah.
And so it was really when I lost my son that I had to find that in nature and find it in the present moment, actually, which was a big challenge because books are kind of atemporal, like they allow you to escape from time.
Yes.
And I was hardcore into that, like for a long time. That was where I lived. A lot of the time I was either with my kids or I was in the land of words.
Yeah.
And so when I lost him, I suddenly lost all desire to be in the land of words anymore and just went complete silence inside me. I had no connection to the value of books or writing or pretty much anything other than my kids.
Yeah.
And so to reconnect in the world and see nature and see, I think really grief really simplifies you. Like it makes you a creature that can just sort of look at a plant and just look at a rock, you know.
Yep.
It's almost like humans are moving way too fast and you can't even see them anymore.
100%.
You know, does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Yeah. It does. It's kind of almost like comparing a city, being in a city and being in nature.
Exactly.
And like a city has so much going on all at once.
Yeah.
Signs and like advertisements and people everywhere.
Totally.
But being in nature is just peaceful and just all one. Like it's all just steady almost.
It seems
almost
so like steady.
Helps you sort of recalibrate yourself.
And it's at such a longer time span. Some people say they feel small when they look at the stars or whatever, but I always just feel really comforted because it's like that time span is reality. I love that time span. Like I can't handle the hectic little time span of 100 years. It's too hectic, you know. Or in my son's case, 19 years. That's a hectically rushed time span, and reconnecting to those more ancient time spans felt really good. I remember before my son passed away, a few months before, he'd had these kind of, I don't know, I hesitate to use the word visionary because it sounds a bit ecstatic or a bit hyperbolic or something, but, and he was unwell, but he had these intuitive feelings that he would want to move to, which place was it? It was like one of those V-line places, which is north. I can't quite think what it is. Like the furthest when you get off the V-line, it's the end point of one of those V-lines where you don't need a car because he didn't have a license and you don't need a car. You could still get on the V-line and come in to find work or to find study or something in Melbourne, but you would be in a peaceful place. And his aim was just like, I'm going to live in a very, it's almost like that dream house that you have, like that dream of the quiet shack. There's probably no electricity. It's just probably, it's not run down. It's a really humble abode, like this peaceful. He was going to get a golden retriever and he was going to live like as far as possible from the city in a quiet, peaceful, natural place. That's what he was dreaming about, you know. He was dreaming about that. And he was also dreaming about going to the nearest port and just getting on a ship, on a boat, and just maybe being like a ship's mate. And we were like joking, like, is that still possible? Can you go to the port and can you say, hey, matey, I want to be a ship's mate? And they're like, oh, we were just waiting for someone like you, young lad, please come aboard and be a ship's mate, whatever that is. We had no idea, but we used to talk about that. And so, you know, he had those feelings. And after he went, I also had those same feelings almost passed on to me.
Yeah. Another thing I wanted to ask, with your experience of being a single mom, and also taking on higher education, like going to university. I know, I think you went to, what age did you go back to university?
I think I went to uni when I was 31. My first daughter was 7 months old, by the way, or maybe seven months old. So I was a single mum with three kids, the oldest being about 12 and the youngest, baby. So that's when I went to uni and did my BA.
Awesome.
Yeah. And now I'm a lecturer, so it's possible.
That's something that a lot of people are really intimidated to do.
Yeah.
The book also definitely touches on to how this could also be like a difficult thing as well.
Oh, definitely. There's a lot about single motherhood in there. Single motherhood shouldn't even really be a term in a way, because what are you even talking about? Like sometimes with single motherhood, it could be a lot of different things. Like if it's a choice, that's one type of single motherhood. If it's someone who's like perhaps become homeless or they've escaped from abuse or violence, then it's enforced.
Mm.
But there's so many different ways of being a single mother. And in my case, the way of being a single mother was very much not by choice. Also, I'm somewhat partly widowed and it's a complicated backstory. But the point is that the single motherhood that I have, I feel like it's not that I'm a single mum. It's more that other people haven't come and stepped up to support us.
Mm-hmm.
And so I feel like they're the ones that maybe need a term to describe what they're doing, which is out of my control. And I'm the single mum. So yeah, it's a very big part of the book, I think, the social issues in Melbourne and what it's like to be a single mum with no network, no support, no money, no job, no education to speak of, and having the politicians sort of frame that as being, oh, you probably should have controlled your womb more or something horrific like this. And, and when actually the problems are social and they're not, I thought our lives were really very much worth having and still are. So absolutely.
It's awesome what you've been able to achieve well and coming from that space. And yeah, I think the book is such a beautiful read. It really helped put myself in your shoes almost and like see the world from the way you see things, which is very fascinating.
I think the emotional palette of the book is really, it has a lot of lightness in it, and I think, you know, that's necessary for us to survive in the world, to keep our feelings of lightness as well, especially while we deal with heavy things. And I just think there are so many voices out there that should be heard about so many topics, and I hope it connects to people who need it as well.
That was Torin Tay Smith speaking with us about her recently released memoir, Honey from the Ground. For listeners, more information on the book, who want more information on the book, we'll include that in the podcast notes for today's program. You're listening to 3CR Tuesday Breakfast.
And now we are joined in the studio by Orly and Alex from Demilitarize RMIT. Orly and Alex are community organizers, researchers, and besties. Their work focuses on care, crisis, and abolition across a range of different contexts, including anti-militarization, transformative justice, and struggles for land band. They're on the show to talk about the upcoming event, Military Industrial Academic Complex, featuring workshops and panels on knowledge building, skill sharing, and organizing in the struggle for political education against the forces of settler colonialism and militarism within and against and beyond the university. Welcome to 3CR, Orly and Alex.
Hi, thank you so much for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, let's jump right in. Who is Demilitarize RMIT and what prompted the formation of the organization? Could you explain how RMIT is being militarized and what that means for the university and its students, Alex?
Yeah, great. Thank you so much. So Demilitarize RMIT is a group of staff, students and alumni working to sever the university's ties with military industries, particularly those complicit in the genocide in Palestine. And we formed in the context of the intensification of the genocide in 2023. So at RMIT, we know that the Sir Lawrence Wackett Defence and Aerospace Centre is deeply embedded within the military industrial academic complex, as are universities across so-called Australia. RMIT maintains research partnerships with some of the world's biggest weapons companies, as well as international departments of defence, which we're really deeply concerned by and oppose. And in terms of what it means for researchers and academics and students, it means that more and more of our funding and efforts are being directed towards military research and development.
Orly, what is the... Could you explain your upcoming event and why it's being held and how RMIT University responded to the actions of this organization?
Yeah, sure. So we're holding a two-day solidarity gathering and resource sharing event, bringing together a range of different projects and campaigns who are engaged in the struggle against the militarization of education, particularly those organizing for Palestinian solidarity and liberation. So the first day of the event is more kind of broadly focusing on the political economy and the broader context around militarization and the academy and its connections to settler colonialism, and focusing on education projects outside of the university. And then the second day is trying to focus on solidarity building and coalition building with groups who are organizing within, against the academy and also other related institutions who are embedded in the military industrial academic complex, and particularly focusing on things like divestment. In terms of the way that the university has responded to Demilitarize RMIT, I mean, they have directly said as much as they know that we exist and they know what we're doing and they don't care too much. They're quite proud of their kind of arsenal of defense and military involvement. And we've had, you know, where we host meetings outside on campus or teach-ins and things like that. And they usually send, you know, just like an unreasonable number of security, sometimes police, to surveil and intimidate us while we're meeting on campus, which is, you know, particularly distressing when we're with our Palestinian and Arab comrades. So, yeah.
And how do you protect the members of this organization from when the university decides to maybe put you in an uncomfortable situation?
So I suppose we try to keep our identity somewhat hidden. There are a number of, I guess, online security measures we take, particularly because so many of our things are linked through RMIT, given so many of us work or study there. And yeah, like the event that we're holding on Friday and Saturday, it won't be recorded. People have all been asked kind of names and pseudonyms. And yeah, it's an ongoing struggle, and something that we're always keen to learn more from other organizations about as well.
Mm-hmm. Alex, could you explain what it means when an institution, specifically a university, is militarized? And could you provide some of our listeners with some context?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. So, like, you know, we're talking about the military-industrial academic complex, which sort of describes this intensifying relationship between military, industry, and academia. And what that means sort of on the ground is that more and more funding and also just kind of the academic and university priorities get funneled into military research and development. So kind of an example of this is just yesterday we got an email about applying for the Strategic Policy Grants Program, which is a defense, Department of Defense grant. And RMIT was like, this is great, researchers apply for it. And the stated purpose of the grant is to provide an external perspective on defense strategic policy decision-making and stimulate public debate. But to be eligible, you somehow have to prove that you support the defense industry's mission, purpose, and priorities. So you can kind of see how more and more your research and your thinking is kind of enclosed within, you know, military priorities. And universities within this are kind of viewed as military assets, you know, producing future workforce for defense. And this is really being accelerated by the AUKUS agreement between Australia, the United States, and the United Kingdom, as particularly the US encourages Australia to expand their military funding.
Which also, you know, creates a really clear pipeline between the university and defence or the military-industrial complex. And students will, you know, like, reflect that they feel like that there are literally no other options. It's like, this is where the career opportunities are. This is where the funding is. So, yeah.
Yeah, bouncing off a little bit of what you said, Orly, how does this affect not only just the students, but other members of the community within the university?
I mean, I think for staff as well, there's probably like similar, or there definitely are similar feelings of there being no other job opportunities, especially as we see like a broader defunding of universities and, you know, arts and social sciences and all that kind of thing. In terms of other members of the community, Alex, do you have?
I guess, you know, because my research in particular is around sort of urban waterways and climate change adaptation. And like, we're kind of seeing money that previously might have been put into other research areas now getting put into military. And just from my own perspective, like, we can't really talk about climate justice while we're like expanding military funding, particularly given the military and armed forces produce so much greenhouse gas emissions. They contaminate lands with like extreme amounts of toxic waste, and they just draw on so, they're so resource intensive. And it's just like a complete contradiction to have one research lab working on, you know, so-called climate justice, while down the road we've got people working on you know, killing machines that are not only killing people, but killing the land.
How do you both understand the university as a site of struggle and the importance of opportunities to resist against the ongoing militarization?
I think that knowledge production and sharing is a really important site of anti-colonial struggle, and the university is implicated in a very long history of settler colonial violence through this process of knowledge extraction and violent knowledge production, and all of those things. So I think that it's our responsibility when we are within the university to be challenging these narratives that normalize settler colonialism, that allow a genocide to continue for 2 years, to allow like the ongoing denial of the context of genocidal violence here as well.
Yeah, and you know, like the Defence Science Institute is like publicly stating that like universities, and particularly Victorian universities, are an important part of their military expansion, and like they're thinking about universities in this context. So it's important for us who are sitting in these places to be like, hang on, wait, no, this is not what we want public funding to be put into, and where like the efforts of academics and students should be going.
What are some of the demands that you've put on the university to kind of comply with your goals as Demilitarize RMIT?
I mean, we've had some demands around like disclosure of ties to weapons companies, to international defense departments and other institutions, demands around divestment from these companies and institutions, none of which have been responded to or met.
Yeah, and I think also more, something else we've been talking about a lot is transparency around its like bachelor's, master's and PhD programs, because there is a lot of there's a lot of advertising around like, come and work for these like amazing global companies. Mm-hmm. But, you know, having conversations with people who have just come out of school, and like this defense company is offering them a huge salary or whatever it might be, there needs to be more transparency in what students are being asked to do, and also where their skills and what the university is teaching them, what the ways that, you know, the government but also the university are expecting them to then go in, what they're expecting them to do with those skills. Mm-hmm. And lots of like, yeah, just from my own conversations with undergrads, they feel really stuck because this hasn't been made clear to them. So yeah, just like way more transparency and then divestment of these. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's really important. Just before we wrap up, how can students and other listeners get involved with Demilitarize RMIT?
So you can find us on Instagram at demilitarizeRMIT. We also, you can send us an email, demilitarizeRMIT@gmail.com. The event on Friday and Saturday is free to attend either in person in Collingwood or online. Mm-hmm. And you just register for the event via our Instagram. And if you want to reach us, send us an email or a DM, and we will be excited to hear from you.
Yes, and please register quickly because we are going to hit capacity very soon.
Yes.
Which is very exciting.
Yes.
Great. Well, thank you so much. It was great to talk to you both about your collective and what you're doing for RMIT.
Thank you so much for having us and talking to us.
You're listening to 3CR, and we've just been speaking to Orly and Alex from Demilitarize RMIT. If you would like to know more about the collective, as well as the upcoming two-day knowledge and skill-sharing event, you can follow them on Demilitarize RMIT on Instagram. Next up will be a song. The song is called Kolan Endan Dababat, roughly translating to They Have Tanks, We Have Stones, and it's by a British-Palestinian rapper, Shadia Mansour, also known as the First Lady of Arabic Hip Hop.
كلنا عندن دبابات وإحنا عنا حجار بيهدموا ببيوتنا بقتلوا بالأطفال يا فلسطين الأحرار يا غزة الأبطال الصهيوني جاي لنهار ترا 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 بإيمانكم ستشفلون عداء صهيونية الإرهابية عنصرية الفاشلة يا شهداء غزة الأبرار يا من تحديت العدو على خط النار وحكم سوف تكون رمز المنار انتصاركم مكتوبة على كل جدار عاشت عاشت فلسطين يا رؤساء والزعمات العرب بعدكم نايمين أين أنتم أين صوتكم يدوي غضبا على هذه
في قصر ورد التجاهل 60 عام تحشروا هالشعب تتآمروا هالشعب تقاتلوا هالشعب تمثلوا في هالشعب والشعب شعب والمحتل محتل قام العالم سوا بين الدم أما عالم مختل بس التاريخ ما بيشفي التاريخ بمحي وانا شايف التاريخ طريق برك عيون شعبي يقولوا لنا قرار أمم احترم بنحترم يقولوا لهم قرار أممي أم يحزب بالزبالة تأخذوا هوش سمعها رمم قيادات جبانة عايشة بعز والشعوب دايما عايشة بإهانة هو عنده أسلحة للزوال وإحنا عنا أسلحة للبقاء عنا حجار عنقودية عنا إرادة نووية وعنا عقول مسلحة بقرار شامل قرار شامل ينادي بالحرية تسلم لنصابيعهم على الفرد يا ابن العرة كلنا غزهم بالعزة الناس زي كل الناس في احساس مش حماس ولا عباس لما شفت غزة انا شفت حالي شفت اطفال تتيدى بين ايدي مع الاهلي اطفالي تموت وانا ابكي افتش على اولادي شفت نسوين تنطف حضانة اختي استشهدت معلي استشهد لاني شفت اخرتي ولما شفت المقاومة انا كنت بدي كنت بدي بس واقعي نصحني اجه
بالنسبة لهم ساحة الحرب لعبة نينتندو شايفيننا نقط مالي إذا ما أنا رقم بعدات جثث
ثقة بيعرضوها كدفاع عن النفس هل هاد غباء أم استعلاء والله مالي نفس أعبر عن رأيي بلاش يسدوا نم ديمقراطية غير محطة زعيم عربي بخطب غير الحطة اللي بيسمعني فكر إنه كان يتوقع مشلول شو اقول الله يساعد غزة وبكره يساعدنا شو اقول اطفالي يابا ما حدش وقف جنبنا يا قائد العرب جاهزه يا بتنزل يا بتنجزها في فراغ سياسي ومطلوب في حل صاحب كاريزما
كلنا عندهم دبابات احنا عنا حجار
Next up, we will be speaking to Georgie Stone, who is the producer of a play called Ascension, which is a play written by Harrison Stone that brings an original Greek myth to life on the stage. You can see Ascension live at the Fringe Festival from October 16th to 19th. We'll be speaking to Georgie Stone today about what Ascension brings to the theater world. Welcome, Georgie.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thank you for coming on to the show. Just jumping right into it, can you explain to our listeners what Ascension is and what the play is about?
Yes, so it is a two-man show. It imagines the Greek myth. There are two separate Greek myths of Dionysus and Apollo. There's a moment where Dionysus is granted godhood by Zeus for inventing wine, and then there's also a myth about Apollo being stripped of godhood. And so Harry, who's written it, who's my brother, has imagined both things happening at the same time. So it's a play about Apollo sort of crashing Dionysus's party celebration of ascending to godhood, and they have this really interesting and kind of fraught and jubilant conversation about if it's better to be a god or better to be a mortal.
Yeah, that sounds super interesting. What is the tone of Ascension, and how are different theatrical elements used to produce that tone?
So the tone, there are moments of great levity in it. It's very funny, but there's, you know, there's a lot of light and shade, I suppose, in it. There are also some dark moments. And there are a few ways in which, I mean, it's quite a small theatre space, but Harry and Dart, who's the director and also plays Apollo, that they've been able to create this sort of epic and quite dynamic feeling in that small space with the band. There's a three-piece band on stage with them, and they play through pretty much the whole show, and it really creates this quite wonderful and transportive atmosphere, which really kind of lands you in Dionysus's bar, which is where it's set. So it's quite involving, I think.
Yeah, would you, since it's a two-man play, would you kind of consider these instruments as sort of another character to help move the story along?
Absolutely. And what's great to see, and something that was very important, I think, in the rehearsal process, was having both Apollo and Dionysus having their own separate relationships with the band. And you can see that there's like a past history between Dionysus and the individual members of the band, and you can see the band members reacting to things that are happening on stage, because it's all supposed to feel, you know, those band members aren't just making sounds. They're real band members in Dionysus's pub. And that's also how we're supposed to feel as audience members. We're Dionysus' followers celebrating with him as he ascends to godhood. And we see in real time that his party interrupted by Apollo. And so they are also interacting with us. And I think it's a great way for us as audience members to feel involved in the story as well.
Yeah, that is such a unique way of utilizing music in theater. What are some of the inspirations that went into creating this piece?
I think for Harry, he loves Greek mythology. He's read the Odyssey and the Iliad. He's read all the things. I think Greek myths are such a great foundation for modern stories. because, you know, the hero's journey and those great big quests and how large scale and epic they are, they kind of inspire everything without us even thinking about it. So I think Harry loved individually those myths of Apollo and of Dionysus, but really wanted to bring them together because they're both two sides of the same coin. They're both, you know, patrons of art and theatre and music and poetry, but Apollo is all about, I suppose, order, and Dionysus is chaos and debauchery. So he wanted to make a myth where the two of them interact because that hasn't happened yet.
Yeah, that's so interesting. What are you hoping to attract with this play, and who is your audience?
It's really everyone who loves Greek myths. I think there's something in that for everyone. But also this play, it's such a love letter to theatre as well, and that was something that both Harry and D'Artagnan were very keen to get across to people, that this is a love letter to theatre. And there was a time not so long ago, you know, during COVID-19, where we were all wondering whether that was going to still exist afterwards, whether we were all going to be able to come into a space again and have that share, you know, fleeting moment that theatre is that can't be replayed. So I think for anyone who loves theatre, whoever, to anyone who's passionate about independent theatre, to anyone who loves Greek myths, to anyone who loves wine, you know, there's a great soliloquy about wine in there. And anyone who just wants to have fun, it's a really, really fun 55-minute play. So if you have time from Thursday through Sunday in the evenings, come to the Ascension. It's a really, really wonderful play.
Yeah, it sounds incredibly exciting. What's been a major highlight of putting together this production, and what makes you the most proud?
I think for me, last week when it was our tech run, there was this moment when everyone was up on stage, the band was playing, we're getting the lighting cues just right, and I was sitting in the audience as the producer, I'm not in it, and just so proud that we have something like Melbourne Fringe for artists to have agency over the stories they want to tell and to put together something that speaks to them as, you know, individual creators. And it was always, you know, Harry and Dart's dream to have a band on stage, and that seemed, you know, like such a, like a big thing for a small fringe stage. Like, we weren't sure if it was possible. But just to see it all come together in the way that Harry and Dart wanted it to just made me, as a producer, very proud that we got to, you know, make that happen, and then it all came together.
That is so wonderful. I'm so excited to see the show. But to close things off, how can our listeners find tickets to see Ascension?
So, tickets can be found on the Melbourne Fringe website on the Ascension event page. So if you look up Ascension Melbourne Fringe, you'll be able to find it. And there is a flash sale on right now, today and tomorrow. Tickets are 25% off if you use the promo code Apollo Dionysus. Very easy. And yeah, buy your tickets soon because they are selling fast, which is very exciting. But yes, get tickets as soon as possible because you do not want to miss out.
Well, it was so lovely speaking to you, Georgie. Thank you so much for coming on 3CR.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Georgie Stone speaking about Ascension, performing from October 16th to 19th at Fringe Festival.
We're LXRP. We love community radio. If you love rock music, subscribe to 3CR, this subscriber drive.
Y Plus Pride Victoria is a not-for-profit organisation dedicated to equality and justice for multigender attracted people including bi, pan, regardless of label, or no label at all. We organise community events and advocate for better policies and services. Bi Plus Pride runs discussion groups which offer a safe and fun space to share your experiences, ask any questions regarding your sexual identity, and provide peer support. Bi Plus Pride is especially keen to hear from multi-gender attracted people in regional and rural Victoria. Donations to Bi Plus Pride are tax deductible. For more information, visit our website at biplusprideVic.org.au, email info@biplusprideVic.org.au, or find us on Facebook or Instagram.
A 3CR supporter.
I'm bisexual.
This deal really accentuates and is very complementary to the White Australia domestic policy. Here you have not only a white alliance, but an Anglo-Saxon alliance of the ultimate cultural allies of the United States banding together, and the significance that it is aimed at colored peoples, at Asian peoples, at Pacific peoples. This is injecting a horrible racial dimension to this conflict. So I think the US and Australian elites' racist military policies are complementing the increasingly racist domestic policies. So I think, therefore, we really have to look out very, very carefully at this very dangerous synergy between racism on the military front and racism on the domestic front.
Subscribe to 3CR. Where else can you hear radical news, analysis, music, and opinions? Go to 3cr.org.au/subscribe or call the station on 03 9419 8377.
You've been listening to Tuesday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. We've had an incredibly big show today, and we are excited to talk about it. At 8:15, you listened to Georgie Stone speaking about Ascension, a play performing at Fringe Festival on October 16th to 19th. Then, at 8 o'clock, we spoke to Orly and Alex from Demilitarize RMIT about their focuses on care, crisis, and abolition across a range of different contexts, and their upcoming event, Military Industrial Academic Complex.
At 7:45, we listened to Soren Tay Smith and her memoir, Honey from the Ground, which discusses grief and child loss and being a single mother. And at 7:30, we spoke with Lucinda Thorpe, about who is with the privacy campaigner at Digital Rights Watch, about the CCT network in NAM. And at 7:15, we spoke with Lisa from the Gippsland Forest Guardians, who was speaking to us about protecting Gippsland's forest from logging and the future of the Strzelecki Forest.
Up next, we have Accent of Women, a program by and about women on 3CR.
If you're a renter with problems such as repairs, getting your bond back, negotiating a rent hike, or facing eviction, it helps to know your rights. For free information and advice on renting, you can visit Tenants Victoria at www.tenants.vic.org.au, Anika Legal at www.anikalegal.com, or contact your nearest community legal centre. The government is planning to demolish and redevelop high-rise public housing towers in Melbourne. If you're living in a public housing tower and need free legal advice about your options, find your nearest community legal centre at www.fclc.org.au. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
You might have heard about the Community Radio Plus app, but it's only when you start using it that you'll wonder how you lived without it.
You can listen to us wherever you are, at home, work, driving,
on public transport, gardening, protesting, or even in the bath.
Just search Community Radio Plus wherever you get your apps.
Hi, this is Jessica.
And this is Daryl.
And we're from Breadline.
Breadline.
And we love listening to 3CR because...
We're on it.
No, because it's a community station.
Oh, yeah, that too.
Giving the voiceless a voice.
Hello. Welcome to ACT. You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.